All right. So we've been going through the book of Zechariah, and if you would be turning with me over to the book of Zechariah in chapter 4, the book of Zechariah in chapter 4. And as always, before we really get started, we want to remind everyone just about what we're reading in this book so far. Now, first of all, this is a book that was written in the post-exile age of Israel, after the people had returned to Jerusalem, after a large group had returned to Jerusalem anyway. And they returned with the hope of rebuilding the temple and rebuilding Jerusalem. But that kind of fell through the cracks after some confrontation with the Samaritans. They had established the altar. They had established the sacrifices. They had built the foundation of the house of the Lord, but the house of the Lord was never fully rebuilt. That is, until the Lord sent a couple prophets along the way to help spur the people in the rebuilding of that temple, and those prophets being Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai, which we talked not too long ago about. And then, of course, you know, he sent Haggai first. He was an older man, an older prophet, and then he sent Zechariah, a younger man. He was a prophet, of course, of priestly descent. This was a few months later, after the first message of Haggai, that Zechariah was sent with a message from the Lord. And his first message from the Lord was pretty simple, and that is that the Lord was going to be with you when you build this house. That was the first message. That's a pretty simple message. And then, as we looked at chapter 1, not long after that message, the Lord gave to him some visions. Visions. 8 different visions that occurred in one night. And in these visions, we have seen the future of Israel laid out. Visions that often looked past the immediate future all the way into the messianic future of the kingdom that is still yet to come. So in many of these visions, we see a dual fulfillment taking place. We see a fulfillment partially during this day of Zechariah's day, and then the fulfillment in its completeness when Jesus Christ comes to rule and reign. Now, we've had a couple of repeating characters in these visions, besides Zechariah, of course, who was in the mall, pretty much. But the first character that we have had from the very beginning is the one who is called the interpreting angel. The interpreting angel. Now, this is the one that Zechariah is provoked by in some cases and questions in other cases. And he is the one who is leading Zechariah through all of these visions, frequently explaining the meaning of what he is seeing. And that is why we call him the interpreting angel. Secondly, we have the angel of the Lord, who has been a repeating character as well. Now, the angel of the Lord, of course, is one who speaks with great authority, is one who speaks for the Lord, as we've seen in this book as well, and we believe that the angel of the Lord in these visions is none other than the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. Now, he is not in every single vision, but he has been in the vision so far. Now, besides these two individuals, so to say, I know they're not really individuals as we might think of them, but besides these two in these visions, we also have two other emerging characters that are of utmost importance. Men that were prominent characters both in the book of Haggai and in the book of Ezra as well. And the very first of these is Joshua. Now, who was Joshua? Joshua was the high priest. You might recall, as we looked at the vision last time, that as Zechariah saw Joshua covered in filth, disgusting filth, and he was standing there between the angel of the Lord and Satan, who was the accuser. And we saw that last time. Now, the second figure that emerges in these visions is I always say his name, Zerubbabel, but it's because I have a hard time saying Zerubbabel. But that's how it really should be said, is Zerubbabel. He was actually a descendant of the kingly line of David. He was allowed to return to Jerusalem, not as king over Jerusalem or king over Israel, but he was allowed to return as a governor. Remember, at this time, in the post-exile age, Israel is not a free nation. They are not under their own sovereign rule. They are under the rule of the Medes and Persians. And you might recall that it's under the reign of Darius, who we've seen mentioned both in this book and in the book of Haggai as well. And I'm mentioning these characters tonight because they are once again going to come central to our understanding of this vision. So now with all that said, in chapter 4, verse number 1, let's read together. It says, "And the angel that talked with me came again and waked me as a man that is wakened out of his sleep." Now remember, all of these visions, they occurred in one single night. A vision and a dream are two different things. A dream is like what Pharaoh had when he had the dream of the cattle, of the fat cattle and the skinny cattle. That was a dream. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. These were messages that were given by God through these dreams, sometimes veiled in certain ways. A vision, though, on the contrary, is a message that is received while the person is consciously awake. Think about Peter there in the book of Acts when he saw the great sheet with all the different animals on it. That was a vision, not a dream, that occurred while he was awake. These visions came to Zechariah at night, but again, they were not passing dreams. They were conscious visions of things that were going to take place very shortly, or again, even into the far future. And again, this is much like we see and as the Apostle John in the book of Revelation, as he had the visions that occurred there, that he saw what was to take place in the future. Or even Isaiah that we mentioned briefly there on Sunday as we talked about Isaiah having the vision of the temple of God and that holy train that filled the temple and the angels shouting, "Holy, holy, holy." So this angel, which is the interpreting angel that I just mentioned a couple minutes ago, that we've seen over and over again, comes to him and wakes him up suddenly from his sleep. And I imagine at this point in time, Zechariah is exhausted. I imagine he's exhausted. He's seen these four visions so far, and I imagine it was very taxing on him here, so he falls asleep, but seemingly not very long before this angel is suddenly waking him up without warning. And I want you to think about, you know, when you're woke up suddenly, what happens? You kind of wake up in a panic, don't you? That's the kind of thing that happens. And you might wonder at the moment, you know, even where you're at. I often do. But being woken up quickly means that you get startled, and that's exactly how he's feeling at this moment in time as he speaks about this angel waking him up as a man who is wakened out of his sleep. And there is that moment of panic there for a moment. And then we begin to see this vision. And what is the vision? Glad you asked. It's right here in the next verse. It says in verse number 2, "And said unto me, What seest thou? And I said, I have looked, and behold, a candlestick all of gold, with a bowl upon the top of it, and his seven lamps thereon, and seven pipes to the seven lamps which were upon the top thereof." Now, what Zechariah sees in this vision is something that is at least partially very familiar to him. In the tabernacle, or in the temple later on, outside of the room of the Holy of Holies there was a candlestick, or a lampstand, or a menorah, whatever you want to call it. They're all the same thing. But that lampstand, that candlestick, that menorah was something of utmost importance. As a matter of fact, I want you to hold your place here with me and turn with me over to the book of Exodus, if you will. Just want to read a few verses over in Exodus. And hopefully many of you all who are reading along in the Bible in the Year program and being keeping up with this, you'll be looking at this chapter tomorrow. So just a little spoiler alert for you. But we're going to be looking in chapter 25. Chapter 25 and down into verse 31. Let's read a couple verses here. In Verse 31 says, "And thou shalt make a candlestick of pure gold. Of a beaten work shall the candlestick be made, his shaft, his branches, his bowls, his knobs, and his flower shall be of the same. And 6 branches shall come out of the sides of it, 3 branches of the candlestick out of one side, and 3 branches of the candlestick out of the other side." Now I'm going to not read everything about how it was made and its description of everything, but we see a structure here, and we see 3 branches coming out from a middle piece here. So we have 3 on each side. Each one of those 3 have lights, and then that middle piece has a light. So we have a total of 7 lights on this candlestick. Now, these branches, they don't hold candles like we think of candles today. Nothing like these candles right here. Those kind of candles did not exist back then. But they were places where a wick was placed upon those. And that little bowl that we see described there would hold oil. And they would burn that wick, and the wick would pull up the oil from the bowl. And that would give that light off. So in chapter 27, a couple chapters over. We're going to look at a couple of verses here because I want you to see how important the burning of this is. So in chapter 27, in verse 20 and 21, it says, "And thou shalt command the children of Israel that they bring thee pure oil, olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn," notice this, "always, in the tabernacle of the congregation without the veil, which is before the testimony. Aaron and his sons shall order it from evening to morning before the Lord. It shall be a statute forever unto the generation on the behalf of the children of Israel." So this candlestick, this lampstand, this menorah was something of great importance. It was to be burning all the time. And the priests would go in and they would keep this thing going twice a day. They would go in and they would trim the wicks and replace the oil and all of these things. And there again, it would stand outside of the Holy of Holies. The menorah is actually a national symbol of Israel. It's become a national symbol of them because it represents their vitality over the years. Not out of their own might, but truly out of the might of the Lord who has raised them up continually. Now, my purpose in bringing you to Exodus was to remind you kind of, again, what that lampstand looked like with its different branches and the bowls and the knobs and all of these things, and how it would be supplied by that pure olive oil. Again, pure olive oil that it was supplied by. So, with that in mind, let's head on back to Zechariah in chapter 4. And now let's get down into, let's see here, where are we at? Well, we'll look back in verse number 2 again, because I want you to look at the description of the candlestick. And when you look at the description of the candlestick, there's something about this candlestick in chapter 4 and verse number 2 that seems something very different from what we just read. And that is as we look at that previous description of the menorah, it had those little bowls on each of the branches that would supply the oil. But here, this menorah that he is saying has this large central bowl. And this large central bowl is feeding the branches, those 7 lights. Now, at first you might think, well, that's no big deal. Here we just have one oil that is piping all the oil to the wicks just the same. It's no big difference. But there is a difference. Because this bowl is representing an oil that needs not to be changed by the priest twice a day. And we see that here in the next verse. So look in verse number 3. It says, "And 2 olive trees by it, one upon the right side of the bowl, and the other upon the left side thereof." So instead of the priest coming in and changing the oil every day to this menorah that he sees, we see that this menorah is being fed directly by these 2 olive trees, one on one side, one on the other, and they're piping that olive oil down into this central bowl, and that bowl is sending the oil to each one of the branches. Kind of like what we might think of piping maple syrup or something like that, except for what? You don't pipe olive oil like sap from a tree, do you? That has to be pressed out of the olive. So this is symbolic. Zachariah would have known this. Anybody would have known this. You can't take olive oil directly from the tree. So this is symbolic of something. But the question is what is it symbolic of? What are these two trees symbolic of in this vision? So in verse 4, he says, "So I answered and spake to the angel that talked with me, saying, What are these, my Lord?" So not only is this vision curious to us, it was curious to Zechariah. Zechariah understood the purpose of the menorah, he understood the purpose of the light, he understood all of that, but he's trying to figure out, what are these trees? What is the symbolic meaning of this? Well, I think verse 5 records for us truly the honesty of this conversation. So look in verse number 5. It says, "Then the angel that talked with me answered and said unto me, Knowest thou not what these be? And I said, No, my Lord." Now, if I was Zechariah, writing this down later, I probably would have skipped this part and went right into the next verse, because what this angel is essentially saying is, you mean you don't know? That's the tone. You don't know what this is? The angel is like speaking to him like he's surprised he doesn't get it. And you might think the angel would give him a direct answer, but that's not the case. Look in verse number 6. "Then he answered and spake unto me, saying, This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel." Zerubbabel. There it goes. "Zerubbabel, saying, Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts." This is often a verse that you might hear quoted, at least partially, that not by might nor by power, but my spirit. You might have heard that several times mentioned in part. You might not have ever realized that the immediate reference was to the building of the temple. You probably didn't know that at all, which is kind of a sad reminder that we need to make sure that we, when we quote things, that we're quoting things within the context of what they are written. The angel now gives Zechariah a message for Zerubbabel here that speaks of how he is to rebuild the temple, rebuild Jerusalem for that matter as well. He first says that the building would not come through might. Now, the Hebrew word for might here speaks of a couple of different things. It can speak of a large force like an army. So you think of a very large army, whether it be the United States Army, maybe the Chinese Army, it's very large. But that is the power of might. But equally, it also speaks of money. A large supply of money can give one much might. Now, then we have this word power. And in the Hebrew there, that speaks of human stamina or ability. God's message to Zerubbabel was that the building of this temple was not going to come through the great ability of man, which was the message that they needed to hear. It also wasn't going to come through the great riches of man as well. And again, that is a message that they needed to hear, because these people that were there were not wealthy people. They were not wealthy people. They were not skilled people. They were not, the best carpenters in the world. They didn't have the people that Solomon had when he built his temple. They didn't have the great wealth and riches that Solomon had. So God is encouraging Zerubbabel that this temple is not going to be built because you're something special. It's not going to be built because you have great wealth. This temple is going to be built because my Spirit is upon you and it is empowering you to build this temple. And I am going to give you every resource you need. Let's keep reading. That's pretty good, isn't it? Who art thou, O great mountain, before Zerubbabel? Thou shalt become as a plain, and he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings, crying, grace, grace unto it. This is a verse of triumph to give to Zerubbabel, and it's saying that nothing is going to stand in his way of building the temple. Again, not lack of resource is going to stand in his way. The Samaritans are not going to stand in his way. The Medes and Persians are not going to stand in his way. When this thing speaks of a mountain being turned into a plain, it means that everything is going to be cleared out of the way so that this temple can be built. So there is a message here of endurance, enduring to the end. And it says that he himself will bring forth that headstone. That is the final stone. It is to be brought forth with great joy and great shouting. And again, this is a message that the people needed to hear, because remember that the people were in part discouraged over what was being built. Remember there back in Haggai that we read several weeks ago now, it says in chapter 2 and verse number 3, who is left among you that saw the house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison? It is as nothing. Those that saw the first house, that the house that Solomon built, that are now in their late 70s and into 80s, They knew that this house that was being built was nothing like the first. You know, back in Ezra in chapter 3, years earlier when they laid the foundation, we learned that the old men cried because of it not holding up to the glory of the first, when the young men, they were shouting for joy that it was just being built. God's message to Haggai, there, as we read in chapter 2, as I just read to you there, was that, listen, all the gold is mine. All the silver is mine. That is, as God was saying, all the gold in the world, it belongs to me. All the silver in the world, it belongs to me. What do we call the streets in heaven? What do we walk on? It's gold. It doesn't matter. These things don't matter to me. He promised that there would be a greater glory in this second temple than there was in the former. And the message that Zechariah is getting to give to it was one to stay on course. Don't get discouraged. Build the temple, and you will be there when the final stone is laid. The next couple of verses reiterate that same thought. Verses 8 and 9 says, moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. And thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto you. The angel declares that in the day that this house is finished by Zerubbabel, that they would all know that this message was from the Lord. This message was from the Lord. They would know this whenever that headstone was laid. This wasn't something that Zechariah was dreaming up because he wanted this to take place, or, you know, he desired to see the building of the temple, so he's going to go to the governor there and say that this is what God wants, when God had never told him that. This message was from God. The proof in the pudding was the fact that the temple was being built and would be built. And by the way, Zerah, Babel was there at the very end. In Ezra chapter 6, it says in verse number 15, and I hope that we don't have to say his name too many more times tonight, but in Ezra chapter 6 and verse 15, it says, "And this house was finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. The word of God came to Haggai and Zechariah in the second year of the reign of Darius." So it took them about 4 years to finish the temple once they started rebuilding it. By the way, that was some 21 years after the original foundation was laid that the house was finally finished. God was faithful to accomplish everything that he said that he would. Now, back here to our reading in verse number 10. It says, "For who hath despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven. They are the eyes of the Lord which run to and fro through the whole earth." The day of small things speaks of the building of the temple. The building of that temple, again, was not as large as Solomon's temple. It was not as ornate as Solomon's temple. It was not filled with the wealth, the gold of Solomon's temple. It was a small thing compared to the first. God says, don't despise the day of small things. Rejoice in it. The seven eyes of the Lord spoken of in this verse speaks of God's complete vision upon them. And he's taking pleasure in the work that is being done. Now, before we leave this verse, I want to say this, and I think that this is a truth for us today as well. And it might be the only thing that you remember from this chapter as the night goes on or as the week goes on. I understand that thinking of a vision of a lampstand and two olive trees does not excite a lot of people as much as it might excite me. But, you know, sometimes as Christians, we who have been Christians for a long time, we tend to romanticize the past. And we think of the way that things used to be when Sunday rolled around. And my kids don't know, and Bethany doesn't know, but when Sundays rolled around, the town shut down. There was nothing open. I remember when there was a grocery store that opened up a few hours after church, and it was always a big decision of whether you're going to stop and get a loaf of bread or something like that, you know. But people had a respect when Sunday rolled around. We remember the days when it seemed like people put a priority on coming to church, or at least bringing their kids to church. You know, sometimes they didn't come, but they'd make sure their kids got to church, dropping them off or whatever it might be. But they understood that there was a need for them to be there. And we remember the days when the church house was seemingly filled with those kids. And we remember the days when it seemed like the church house was filled full of teachers for those kids. And we remember the days when people yearned for a week-long meeting instead of a weekend special service. We look around sometimes and we think of what a sad shadow of what it used to be like. But you know, we need to stop that. We need to stop that because the men in Zechariah's day were not to live in the past. Living in the past doesn't do anything for your future. We're not to live in the past as well. We're to serve him today. It might be smaller than before. It might be the day of small things. You know, God can take small things and do great things when people are faithful to do his will. God said the glory of the second house was going to be greater than that of the first. And we need to understand that God still gets glory when His churches are being faithful to do His will, even when there is a faithful few. God still gets glory, not by the power and might of our own ability, but as the Spirit enables and gives us talents to do all that He has called us to do. Folks, this may be a chapter to encourage Zerubbabel, but it should be an encouragement for us today as well, to not get discouraged over the small things, but to delight in them. Now let's look back in verse number 11. The angel has given Zechariah a message to give to Zerubbabel. In verse number 11 it says, "Then answered I, and said unto him, What are these two olive trees upon the right side of the candlestick and upon the left side thereof?" Zechariah heard the message that he was supposed to give, but the angel never answered his question. You remember the question back in verse number 4. Who's the two olive trees? What's this all about? The ones that the angel thought that he should know the answer to right away. So Zechariah is not given up. He's not forgotten. He wants to know what these symbolize. The angel must have just looked at him, because in verse 12, we now read, "And I answered again and said unto him, What are these two olive trees which through the golden pipes empty the golden oil out of themselves?" This is the third time Zechariah is asked. Verse 13, the angel answers. You've got to love it. "And he answered and said, Knowest thou not what these be? And I said, No, my Lord." So the angel's answer is like it was before. You really don't know what these are? I can almost see Zechariah being exhausted and ready to pull his hair out. Talking to this angel is like talking to a brick wall. But Zechariah wants an answer for this symbolism, and he finally gets it in verse 14. Then said he, "These are the two anointed ones that stand by the Lord of the whole earth." Well, that just answered everything, didn't it? I mean, everybody knows exactly what he's talking about, right? Well, who are these two anointed ones? The phrase "anointed ones" means sons of oil. So who are these sons of oil that stand by the Lord? The answer is not something mystical. It's not something we're supposed to make into something more difficult than what it is. The answer is this. The anointed ones are Zerubbabel and Joshua, the governor and the high priest. It was through their leadership that the temple was built. They were God's representatives here on this earth to build the house of the Lord. And it further shows the welfare of the temple was to come both through the political and through the spiritual leadership of Israel. I want you to understand that God's system of government never saw a separation of state and religion. It will someday be like that again. Now, one of these days, of course, when it is like that, it's going to be because Jesus Christ comes. When Jesus Christ comes, He will be both the political leader and He will, of course, continue on as our high priest. And it will be Him who gives light into the world. You see, all these things, even though they had a local fulfillment, they're still pointing forth into the future as well. Now, that brings us to the end of the chapter, and we are going to end there with that. As we look next time, Lord willing, into chapter 5, we're going to look at a flying squirrel in a basket. It's going to be exciting next time around, but we're going through these pretty quick at this point in time. So that'll be the next two visions, and then just one more following that, I believe. So maybe not that one. Might get it there. False count. So with that, we'll go ahead and end tonight.